Okay, I'd like to begin with a brief, quick summary of the points I made earlier. One, the victory of the Soviet Union in World War II left the Soviet Union as the occupying power in six European, East European countries ruined by war, in which a backward form of capitalism, not unlike that in the colonial world, had generally prevailed in the pre-war years. By agreement with the imperialists, the Stalinists agreed to preserve the capitalist system in these areas and to establish coalition governments to run the country. Broad and real coalitions were established in Hungary and Czechoslovakia. In the other countries, the imperialists compelled the Soviet Union to impose right-wing anti-Soviet forces and governments that were dominated by local Stalinists and their bourgeois hangers-on. Really, the Soviet bureaucracy saw these areas as a military buffer zone against any future invasion and also as sources of plunder and trade for its own shattered economy. Four, the Soviet bureaucrats evinced no tendency to annex these countries as they had the Polish Ukraine in 1939. They called for the defense of capitalism, and the occupying forces acted as guardians of the capitalist, for the decrepit remains of capitalist property relations. Although the old bourgeois state apparatuses had been largely smashed by the war, a start was attempted toward building new bourgeois state apparatuses, with the local Stalinists taking special care to maintain a predominant, although not complete, position in the new army and police forces that were formed. Even here, however, power was shared with the local military, within the local military forces with bourgeois forces. Five, despite official encouraging discouragement from the Stalinists, mass uprisings of workers occurred in all the occupied countries. The demand was universal for an end to the old semi-colonial order, which had usually been dominated by British capital. These uprisings were not a response to an impulse from the Stalinists, but to the victories of the workers' state over Nazism. They expressed a mass desire to rebuild society along the lines that had brought success to the Soviet Union. These upsurges, opposed by the Soviet bureaucrats, graphically illustrated the gulf separating the Soviet workers' state with its inherently revolutionary dynamic and needs, and the Stalinist bureaucrats with their inherently counter-revolutionary dynamic and needs. Six, the weakened condition of the Soviet Union barred the bureaucrats from seeking a head-on confrontation with the leaderless mass upsurge. They combined a policy of repression, concessions, bureaucratic misleadership, and systematic demoralization of the mass movement. First, they abolished landlordism, seeking a stable, pro-status quo base for the occupation regimes by creating a large class of small landowners that would be a majority of the population. Second, they did not crush the workers' movement by means of a bloodbath, as they had done in Spain in the 1930s, but subjected it to tight bureaucratic command, taking over the workers' councils that were formed and depriving them of their dual power content. The Stalinist-dominated workers' movement thus became a means of disciplining the workers in the interest of capitalism, of putting pressure on recalcitrant capitalists to cooperate with the Stalinists. But it also put pressure on the Stalinists to maintain this base by instituting social reforms. The concept of people's democracy used by the Stalinists to designate these regimes was put forward to assure the masses that a reform system was being built. Capitalism in the East was a wreck. The native capitalists had been shattered by the Nazis and further demoralized by the mass uprising. Their survival required the protection of the Soviet bureaucracy, but it also required foreign capital that only the U.S. could provide. The Soviet policy of plunder through reparations, theft of factories, joint stock companies, and trade agreements, far more favorable to the Soviet Union than world market prices would justify, placed the capitalists in an economic bind that pushed them towards reestablishing ties with U.S. imperialism. Since neither the workers nor the capitalists had been definitively beaten, since neither could abide the existing situation, and since the latter, the capitalists, were permitted to retain their property in general and a powerful influence in the state apparatus, a powerful social explosion was maturing. Nine, the main goal of the Soviet bureaucrats was a long-term peaceful coexistence deal that would assure the status quo, that is, the existence of capitalism on a world scale which is a condition for the survival of bureaucratic rule. This such an agreement would also recognize the Soviet defense perimeter, neutralize areas like China, and at the same time make Western loans, investments, and goods available to the Soviet economy. It was not dissimilar in essence to their goals in the present-day times. Stalin appears to have hoped that such an outcome would make it possible to restore the Soviet economy under bureaucratic auspices, stabilize the buffer zone on a capitalist basis but as a Soviet sphere of diplomatic influence, and reduce the socially explosive plunder of these regimes. Such an economic stabilization would have made it possible to definitively quiet the workers' demands for change, as was done in Western Europe through Stalinist misleadership of the workers and the Marshall Plan, and through the Marshall Plan. Now, while these governments were subject to Soviet dictate on most matters of substance, they were not too much interfered with on questions of day-to-day policy. Within these limits, all these governments made serious efforts to get capitalism going again. On the question of nationalization of industry, each country adopted a different policy, with Poland and Czechoslovakia being the only ones to undertake large-scale nationalization. These were qualitatively different from the nationalizations that resulted in the final crushing of the bourgeoisie and the creation of worker states. In Czechoslovakia, at the end of 1945, 60% of industry was brought under government control. Now, this was mostly abandoned, ruined, or predominantly German-owned industry. The aim was to get production going again. These measures were firmly defended by Eduard Beneš, the leader of Czechoslovakia's National Socialist Party and one of the country's most conscious bourgeois politicians for three decades. One motive of the nationalizations was to get property out of the control of workers' councils in some areas and under the control of the coalition government. It was therefore another measure of assuaging the workers' demands for change while weakening their power and strengthening the capitalist system. Despite its scope, it was similar to nationalizations undertaken by the Labour government in England, and even more similar in some ways to nationalizations in backward countries like Egypt and Burma, where enterprises that are unprofitable for the capitalist to operate individually but necessary for a real viable capitalist system are nationalized. The measure was undertaken so the capitalists were not only compensated, except for the Germans, but to continue to profit from the businesses. Over 10,000 enterprises, including almost all the key industries, were involved. Now, when I say all the key industries, what I mean is all the key major industries. Now, around half the Czechoslovakian working class still worked for private capitalists, even at this time. But that was in industries that employed less than 50 or 60 people. So you have to remember, much of industry in these countries was at a very primitive level. Even this left a gigantic seedbed for future large-scale capitalist development. Beneš assured the West that all these firms would be run, quote, strictly according to the rules of free enterprise. All of these enterprises were placed under the control of managers, mostly under their old management. Non-German owners were often allowed to select the managers. Since the workers' councils controlled by the Stalinists were no longer an immediate threat, the new state industries came under the sway of a bureaucracy of old owners, managers, capitalist party politicians, plus a new crop of Stalinist and social democratic recipients of patronage. The overall plan, as it was called, for the country was drawn up by the Economic Council, consisting of six ministers, at least half of whom came from the bourgeois parties, the other half being social democrats or Stalinists. Each industry was operated independently with its own accounting system, etc. In other words, there was no real plan, and there was no pulling together of these industries into a common national system. Now, the capitalist character of this nationalization was further guaranteed by the issuance of state bonds in lieu of previous individual shares. Interest on these bonds, like the dividends of shareholders, was to be the first charge on profit. Nothing like this exists in any worker state, not even Yugoslavia, where the thing has become most diluted. So these independently run firms, or organized firms, run by their own managers, were intended to be dedicated first of all to the profits of the new layer of bondholders and bond buyers. All of this rested on a base of small industry, wholesale and retail trade, which were almost entirely privately owned. In addition, the vast corruption the regime encouraged and the absence of a real central plan encouraged bureaucratic managers to turn themselves into real capitalists on a small scale, a policy which Stalinist ideology did not immunize CP members against. We should see this also in countries like, for instance, Egypt, where a whole new layer of capitalists was developed out of the army through the nationalizations that Nasser carried out. This layer that's now surfacing under the denasserization and beginning to take direct control of different industries and emerge as owners of industries, whereas before they had been subjected to some kind of national control. It's interesting to note that in most of the countries where the Stalinists had a firmer grip on the government, as countries like Bulgaria, countries like Romania, places like that, but where the working class was smaller, nationalizations were almost completely absent. The bourgeois-dominated Hungarian government was another example. However, nationalization measures of a somewhat lesser scope were also taken in Poland. In Poland, around two-thirds of the workers continued to work in private industry, because small industry carried an even bigger weight in the economy than it did in Czechoslovakia, which was a little more advanced. Poland is an especially interesting case because it reveals the real post-war policy of the U.S. imperialists, a policy that was to explode Stalin's dream of post-war class peace and to force him and the parties under his command to take a partial left turn. Now, the Polish bourgeoisie never accepted or agreed to the division of their country by Stalin and Hitler in 1939, and the removal of the Polish Ukraine from their sphere of capitalist exploitation. While they were anti-Nazi, they never cooperated with the Russians, and they set up an anti-communist government in exile in London, which had ties with a massive Polish resistance movement known as the Home Army. When the Russians entered Poland, they set up a pro-Soviet government in Lublin, a small town in Poland, opposed to the exile government in London. The exile government was headed by the bitterly anti-communist leader of the more or less liberal or reformist Polish Peasant Party, a man named Mikołajczyk. The Stalinist-dominated government was pro-capitalist in its policies, but the only difference was that it did not demand the return of the territory seized from Poland by Stalin. The London government did demand that. Now, Stalin did not attempt to win the masses away from the London government. He took a different tack. When the pro-London government, Home Army, launched an uprising in Warsaw in August 1944, an uprising supported by the whole working class, the peasantry, just about everybody, Stalin's armies waited outside Warsaw while the Nazis brutally chopped the uprising to pieces, destroying Warsaw in the process, and the cream of the Polish working class was killed in the course of this uprising. Then after Warsaw had been destroyed, the Russians marched in, set up their Lublin Committee as the government, and arrested any surviving resistance army guerrillas they could catch. Despite this encouragement to complete demoralization, the workers throughout Poland seized factories and occupied them, often under less social democratic leadership. At first, the West refused to recognize the new government, insisting that the white London government in exile be involved in running the country. So the Russians included their bitter enemy, Mikołajczyk, in the government and allowed his Polish Peasant Party to function legally, although not without obstructions and periodic repression. The bourgeois leadership of the anti-Nazi resistance, added to the hatred felt for the Stalinists because of their treatment of Poland and their betrayal of the anti-Nazi movement, provided the basis for a capitalist military assault against the pro-Stalinist government, an assault backed by Mikołajczyk and his party, as well as by the State Department and the U.S. ambassador on the scene. This was a rather strong sign that the relationship that the Stalinists sought with the United States was not going to come off. But the Stalinists decided to keep Mikołajczyk in the government despite this, which is a strong indication of how seriously Stalin wanted to deal with the imperialists. At first, the Russians tried to combat this armed right-wing uprising with Russian troops. They seized 5,000 suspected dissidents and sent them to the Soviet Union. This had the effect of building up the popularity of the resistance, and the Russians were confronted with the possibility of a long and expensive fight, the last thing they needed. So they began to build up local Polish security forces using the Polish CP as a base. This required creating some degree of popular acceptance for the regime. A sweeping land reform and extensive nationalization helped them to do this. Since the Polish bourgeoisie was unalterably hostile to a pro-Russian regime, simply because it meant there would be the destruction of the old Polish empire, and the peasants were sympathetic to their traditional leaders, the workers and the very poor peasants provided the only possible social base for the Stalinists at that moment. Hence the nationalizations, which were aimed in part at weaning the workers away from sympathy for the right-wing nationalists, which was felt by many workers at the time on a national basis. The nationalizations had the same limitations as in Czechoslovakia. That is, they were intended to permit the recovery of capitalism, with the proviso in this instance that the capitalists could be convinced to cooperate. Now, the word civil war has been thrown around very loosely of late. The SLA, which at the time I wrote this was still a viable organization, believed that the kidnapping of Patricia Hearst was an incident in a civil war. But in the interest of the caution, I will call this situation a small-scale civil war. Nevertheless, it was quite violent. For instance, in November 1946, the government announced that 2,483 security agents of the government had been killed. But the rebels gradually lost ground. Nobody wanted to reverse the land reform that had been carried out or to return factories to their old owners. Anti-Semitic pogroms, which the nationalists engaged in and which were backhandedly defended by the U.S. ambassador, explained that there were too many Jews in the government, isolated them further. The Polish peasant party split when Mikołajczyk came out in opposition to a democratic reform that he had claimed to support in the pre-war era, the elimination of a non-elected Senate or something like that. These reforms were submitted to a referendum and he lost handily. When the Polish government declared an amnesty for the rebels in January 1947, more than 55,000 rebels turned themselves in, which is a sign that you had a movement of a considerable scope. Mikołajczyk was kept in the government for a time as an earnest of their intention to preserve capitalism, as an earnest to the imperialists of that. But his party was subjected to regular purges and went into a sharp decline. While the country remained capitalist in its fundamental social structure, a decisive effort by the capitalists to reassert themselves on the political level had been beaten back. This defeat was dealt not only by the Soviet forces, which tried to remain in the background after their first efforts backfired, but by Polish security forces organized by the Polish CP under Moscow's direction. The attempt to win the masses from the right-wing nationalists, attempt that was never exactly complete, but at least sort of gradually neutralized them and won over some, led to the development of nationalist and left wings in the Communist Party itself, one of which was headed by the party secretary, Władysław Gomułka. Now, this victory was not an automatic function of the Soviet occupation, but it required a bitter struggle against one-time reformist leaders of the bourgeoisie, in the course of which the remains of bourgeois property and power were further weakened. This experience throws some doubt on the claims of those who looked upon the transformations in Eastern Europe as a cold process, a peaceful process flowing automatically from Soviet occupation. Well, the events of in Poland were a clue of what American policy was at that time. The acceptance of Soviet occupation of Eastern Europe had been forced on the imperialists in order to assure full Stalinist cooperation in salvaging France, Greece, Italy, and the colonies. All countries, by the way, in which Stalinist parties and Stalinist-dominated military forces had established political predominance at the war's end. From the beginning, however, the U.S. and Britain gave every encouragement to bourgeois elements who were plotting to drive the Russians out. The bourgeois leaders in these countries, not satisfied with the protection given to private property except for Soviet plunder, organized underground oppositions preparing for a hoped-for Western intervention. The United States had entered the war in a position, as it thought, of world domination. No capitalist power could stand up to it, and it had the sole possession of the atomic bomb. The U.S. imperialists were not satisfied to see Eastern European countries dominated by the Soviet Union and its subject parties, even though the Stalinist willingness to preserve capitalism there was quite apparent. They had no confidence that such parties, not tied by close social bonds to the capitalist order like bourgeois parties, could adequately defend capitalist property relations in a future revolutionary crisis. Second, U.S. imperialism had no desire to see the trade relations of these countries oriented toward the Soviet Union instead of toward U.S. imperialism. They wanted these countries to be open, just as they wanted China to be, to the unlimited economic penetration of U.S. capital. They would have blocked the development of independent capitalist classes in that area, just as they do in the colonial world, let alone capitalist classes politically allied to the Soviet bureaucracy. Further, the rapid evolution of the Yugoslav regime, which was a sort of a partially separate development, towards becoming a worker state, when there had been a 50-50 deal arranged in the meeting between Churchill and Stalin, indicated that the Soviet Union's bureaucratic leadership was not fully able to control the revolutionary dynamic unleashed by the Second World War. But above all, with its monopoly of the destructive power of the atomic bomb and its massive economic power, U.S. imperialists had set themselves the goal of constructing a coalition of capitalist powers capable of overturning the worker state in the Soviet Union and creating what Time magazine called at the time the American Century. This dictated rearmament of the West and stabilization of West European capital and increasing pressure on the capitalists in the buffer zone to break their alliance with the Stalinists and, if possible, pull their countries back into the U.S. orbit in time for the coming showdown. In addition, the anti-communist crusade played a role in dampening labor militancy in the United States. The signs of this were many, although Stalin hung on to the perspective of class collaboration until long after the real policy was crystal clear. A Moscow conference of foreign ministers aimed at discussing post-war economic aid from the U.S. to the Soviet Union broke down with no progress at the end of 1945. In addition, the West barred the Soviet Union from collecting most of the agreed-on reparations from the western zone of Germany, forcing Stalin to increase his exactions from the eastern zone. In the midst of famine, the United Nations Relief and Reconstruction Agency cut off food assistance to Eastern Europe. Major loans to Czechoslovakia and Poland were canceled, although the aim of the government in seeking these loans was to get capitalism back on its feet. This was a clear signal to the capitalists and the capitalist parties that their cooperation with Stalin would not be looked on kindly by the world's major source of capital for reconstruction, the USA. In March 1946, Winston Churchill, in a speech at Fulton, Missouri, announced to the applause of Harry Truman that an Iron Curtain had descended on Eastern Europe and called for a crusade to break Soviet control in that area. The actual Iron Curtain that was being brought down by the West, that is, they were determining on a policy of no assistance, no aid, no trade, and a policy of preparing for war, and with the aim of hoping that the countries of Eastern Europe could be stirred to rebellion, essentially, against the Soviet Union. As this policy escalated, of course, the bourgeois elements in the buffer zone responded by increased resistance to their Stalinist allies. In doing this, they counted on popular hostility to the Soviet occupation and Soviet plunder to give them a popular base. This led to the beginning of purges of bourgeois parties and figures that had been involved in the coalitions at the start, especially in Bulgaria and Romania. Plots against the government were discovered. Some were frame-ups, some were real, but most of them at this stage were probably real. The Soviet Union was interested in maintaining these alliances as long as it could. In February 1947, Truman announced a plan of military aid to Greece and Turkey and declared U.S. intentions of building a ring of bases around the Soviet Union. This was known as the Truman Doctrine. This was an implied threat to intervene in the Soviet zone if an opposition rebellion from the right could be stirred up. The bourgeoisies of the eastern zone were now clearly on notice to line up with the U.S. for the approaching conflict, which looked likely to be another world war, and which most people thought was going to happen rather soon. This led to the collapse of one of the most viable and real of Eastern European coalitions, the Hungarian coalition that was led by Ferenc Nagy and Béla Kovács of the capitalist smallholders' party. Here, property had remained overwhelmingly in private hands. The Catholic Church, headed by the ultra-reactionary Cardinal Mindszenty, was allowed to make its propaganda with complete freedom. Mindszenty went on a campaign against a divorce referendum at the time, claiming that legalized divorce would result in a gigantic wave of rape in the country and in other types of perversion. He went on the radio and made a speech about this. There was no special statistics on whether the rape increased after the divorce had been passed, but it passed. But at any rate, these people, these right-wing forces, were free to operate. In Hungary also, the bourgeoisie was frightened by the dead end produced by the Soviet drain on the economy. Inflation reached such a point because of this continual drain of money, that the Hungarian currency, which was called the pengő, exchanged at a rate of 29 quadrillion, 667 trillion per dollar at one point. Now, an economy with that kind of inflation is clearly not long for this world. In other words, there was nothing you could do with that currency. I mean, you couldn't buy the paper that it was written on with the currency. That kind of thing. The leaders of the Smallholders Party began to make contact with the State Department to indicate their interest in shifting their allegiances. The foreign minister told a U.S. aide that his party favored, quote, the bourgeois mode of living, quote, but are opposed by a minority of industrial workers who are pro-Eastern in their sentiments and are not interested in the continuation of a middle-class Hungary. Mindszenty predicted that, quote, the Americans will soon use the atom bomb to drive the Soviets out of Hungary, quote. Mindszenty was always sort of up front about things. And the U.S. ambassador warned the smallholders, Prime Minister Ferenc Nagy, not to make any further concessions to the leftists. So the Stalinist-dominated secret police began to uncover rightist plots in the army against the Stalinists. Béla Kovács, the leader of the Smallholders Party, threatened to call out the peasants against his coalition partners. In March 1947, Kovács was arrested and Nagy went into exile. The Smallholders Party maintained a majority of the post, and other parties still participated in the government. Capitalist-property relations were maintained, but a political confrontation on the political arena had been lost by the bourgeoisie. That is, those who remained were those who were most ready to cooperate and collaborate with the Stalinists. The leaders of the party were out. Sweeping purges cleared the main capitalist representatives from the state apparatus. Now, if Kovács had been able to arouse the peasants against the government, the Stalinists would have had a handful of trouble, and the U.S. imperialists might have been able to intervene. As you could see in the Hungarian Revolution of 56, when the Soviet Union was in a much stronger position, that when the masses in Hungary rise up, it was an extremely tenuous position for the Russians. And in the world situation that existed in 47, with the Russians not having the bomb, if they had an uprising in a country like that, the United States could have intervened and possibly won a country back to its side in the Cold War. But despite their electoral popularity, the smallholders could not arouse any mass support for a shift to the right, even though the Stalinists had aroused no particular enthusiasm. Having lost their base in the bourgeoisie, the Stalinists were still faced with the decision with whether to eliminate capitalism. Given the continuing and deepening economic crisis, they had relatively little choice if they were to avoid a mass reaction, that is, from the left at this point, an especially dangerous reaction given the diplomatic context. The only alternative to overturning capitalism was to convince the United States to reverse its course and include the Soviet Union in the buffer zone in a broad plan of economic aid and peaceful coexistence. So the Stalinists still hung on to capitalism throughout the area, including preserving the monarchy of King Michael in Romania. The Stalinist daily Syntaya, on November 8, 1946, which this would-be feudal monarch, quote, a long life, a good health, and a reign rich in democratic achievements. You know, the first democratic achievement of a monarchy, of course, would be to cease to have a reign rich in anything, and just non-existent. So they wanted him to carry out a lot of democratic achievements. Throughout the area, property relations remained capitalist, thus preserving the ultimate source of power of the bourgeoisie in supporting the worker to the capitalist at the point of production. It was the Marshall Plan and the subsequent struggle in Czechoslovakia that was the lead Stalin to make an irrevocable decision. In May 1947, George Marshall made a speech offering grants and aid totaling billions to restore European capitalist economies. Although Stalin suspected that this was a further anti-Soviet move, the offer did not expressly exclude the Soviet Union and the buffer zone. A foreign ministers' conference was held in June 1947, and Molotov, still hopeful, attended with 89 economists and technicians to work out the details of aid to the Soviet Union and the Soviet zone. The French Communist Party endorsed the Marshall Plan. The bourgeoisies of Eastern Europe saw it as their last chance. Molotov was to be disappointed. In order to get Marshall Plan aid, he was informed by the capitalist powers that all economic plans in the region would have to be subjected to the approval of a U.S.-dominated board. Trade barriers granting Moscow special privileges were to be lifted. The message was clear. The U.S. goal was the subordination of the Soviet economy to U.S. imperialism, and nothing else would do. East European governments that wanted to participate would have to break their economic ties with the Soviet Union and move toward an alliance with the U.S. Molotov withdrew in a rage on July 2nd. But on July 4th, the Czech coalition government, at the urging of John Masaryk, approved the Marshall Plan. That is 2 days after it had been rejected by Molotov and at the conference. On July 6th, CP leader Klemens Gottwald, the leader of the Communist Party of Czechoslovakia, who had supported the decision to endorse the Marshall Plan 2 days after Molotov had rejected it, led a delegation to Moscow to discuss this with Stalin. Stalin was curt. He said to accept the Marshall Plan was to collaborate with the enemies of the Soviet Union and to end friendship with the Soviet Union. Gottwald pleaded that Czechoslovakia needed foreign exchange, but to no avail. And this gives you some idea of how integrated some of these Stalinists have become in trying to operate a capitalist system. Here is what the guy was pleading was that to have capitalism, we need foreign exchange. You've got to let us get into the Marshall Plan. This was the head of the Communist Party in Czechoslovakia. He was even coming into conflict. He was coming into conflict with the Soviet Union, you know. I mean, he came around. But all the buffer zone countries were ordered to reject the Marshall Plan. Partly, I think, because of this problem with Czechoslovakia that made him worry probably that his own forces were beginning to go off in different directions, Stalin organized the Cominform to coordinate the buffer zone and the European CPs in the struggle against the United States' defenses. At the first meeting of the Cominform in September 1947, Yugoslavia, where capitalism had been definitively eliminated, began to be pointed to as a model. This was before the Stalin-Tito split. At that point, Stalin was pointing to them as a model of a workers' state that was 100% loyal to Stalin and 100% anti-Marshall Plan. By the end of the year, the monarchy had been eliminated in Romania, and major nationalizations without compensation were being carried out. In Bulgaria, virtually all industrial property, wholesale trade, and most retail trade had been abolished. This was one of the countries where there was the greatest tension. It was right on the border with Greece, and the capitalists there were continually hopeful that the British army, which was trying to crush the revolution in Greece, might decide to, you know, take a trip across the border and repeat the process in Bulgaria. These developments led to the breakdown of the Czech coalition as well. Expecting that the Stalinists would soon lose support because of the economic stagnation of the country, the bourgeois elements went on the offensive. The National Socialist Minister of Justice, always remember, National Socialist is just a liberal bourgeois party here, it doesn't mean the same thing that it means in Germany, began to arrest leading CP members, and the Stalinist Minister of the Interior arrested leading National Socialists. Then the National Socialist Minister of Justice would release the National Socialists who the Minister of the Interior had arrested, and the Minister of Interior would release the Communists, and it began to become quite a revolving process. But it was obviously, the tension was mounting as the door went around and around. Struggles developed over attempts by the Stalinist Minister of the Interior to replace National Socialist police chiefs in various districts with Stalinist police chiefs. Now, there were only 10,000 Russian troops in Czechoslovakia. not enough to determine the country's fate in its fundamental crisis. The Stalinists decided on a sharp left turn in order to keep their grip on the government. In order to restore their popularity, they called for extending the nationalization, wage increases across the board for all employees, stuff like that. When the National Socialist Minister of Justice attempted to denationalize a chocolate factory, it sounds minor, but it was obviously a test case, the Stalinists led a strike which prevented this measure. When Prime Minister Gottwald, he was the Prime Minister in this government, granted a sweeping wage increase in response to a national contract negotiation, 12 National Socialist and Social Democratic ministers quit and went out into the countryside to organize mass opposition to the Stalinist measures. They demanded that Gottwald resign and a new government be established. Simultaneously, in February 1948, a National Congress of the Stalinist-controlled Workers' Councils was gathering. These 8,000 delegates called for strikes and factory occupation in opposition to the attempt to overturn the Stalinists. In addition, the CP armed these delegates and marched them to the Capitol building to demand that Bennett, the president of Czechoslovakia, who had been supporting the movement against the CP, accept their resignations and reaffirm Gottwald in his post as prime minister. Bennett broke under this pressure, and he did it. So that was the effect of breaking of bourgeois political power in Czechoslovakia. The 12 protesting capitalist ministers, like their counterparts in Hungary, had been unable to raise a single significant demonstration in favor of a move to the right. 1 month later, John Masaryk, one of the remaining bourgeois ministers, either voluntarily or with a little help from his friends, jumped out of a window. In June, Bennett resigned and went into exile. Meanwhile, nationalization began to gain ground. Now, the nationalization process was still held back in a lot of these countries. That is, Stalin continued to hold back on this process in the hopes of finding something to negotiate about for as long as possible. But by 1948 and 1949, it had occurred almost everywhere except Austria, which had been allowed to participate in the Marshall Plan, and which the imperialists had not tried to rearm and draw into the alliance. But the imperialists sort of used Austria. They always have different policies going so that they can have an option. And they used Austria as an experiment of how cooperative the Stalinists could be. In Austria, they allowed the country to remain neutral. They did not rearm it. And in fact, the Stalinists throughout the entire occupation of Austria, which lasted for 10 years, preserved capitalist-property relations and a capitalist government the whole time. This whole process that went on in these other countries didn't occur in Austria at all, simply because it didn't come under attack in the Cold War in the same way. It was used as a signal. Both sides were signaling each other that the game being played by the other side didn't work out, maybe they could talk. And by mid-1949, Georgi Dimitrov, the Stalinist chief of Bulgaria, announced that really people's democracy was just a form of the dictatorship of the proletariat. That showed that even the Stalinists were now aware that a qualitative line had been crossed. The new regimes were incompatible in their property relations with capitalism. However, because the Soviet Union had not structurally assimilated these countries and made them part of the Soviet Union, each had its own bureaucracy with its own interests that were in some ways opposed to the Soviet bureaucracy. And we have to see what some of the fundamental things about these countries having become worker states. The working class in these countries was 100% in favor of these transformations. There was never, not only was there not opposition, but it was always possible for the Stalinists to mobilize a certain amount of support whenever they had to make a move against the capitalists. It was never possible for the capitalists to mobilize any significant support on the other side, even though there was passive discontent in a lot of quarters. So essentially, the overturn in property relations is distinct from the government that was formed, was something that the working class felt quite committed to and quite committed to preserving. That was something that became more apparent later than it was at the time. But in fact, if you watch the process at the time and the factory seizures and stuff like that, you can see that this is what the working class is also pressing for, that this is, in a sense, a limited concession to the workers, as well as being necessary in the context of the Cold War. So that a situation had been created now, and that's what it really meant when they started talking about the dictatorship of the proletariat, where they knew that they could no longer make a deal to restore capitalism, or to make a deal to maintain capitalism without a full-scale counter-revolution. Before then, they could have done it. They would not have needed, maybe in 1947, if the capitalists had dealt, if the capitalists had dealt at the time of the Marshall Plan, the old apparatus could have been used and the old property relations could have been maintained and even possibly restored. At least there would have had to be a struggle over the question, and the Stalinists would have been on the side of the bourgeoisie. Now it was too late. That's what Dimitrov was really announcing. He was saying to the word imperialists, well, you know, in the immortal words of the guy who's an easy rider for this, he'd say, you blew it, you know, as far as Eastern Europe is concerned. During the same period, a somewhat different process had been occurring in Yugoslavia. In 1941, with the German invasion of Yugoslavia, mass peasant uprisings began. Now, at the very beginning, the Communist Party does not seem to have played an initiating role in these because Stalin was allied to Hitler. Therefore, they were not in favor of mass uprisings against the German invasion. In June 1941, when Hitler invaded the Soviet Union, Tito and the Communist Party began to play a central role in these peasant uprisings. And I think you had the first full-scale example of what is today called People's War. Now, Tito was an old-time Stalinist operator who had fought in Spain. Now, when a leading, and he was a member of the Executive Committee of the Communist International. Now, when a leading Stalinist fought in Spain, it was more often with the GPU battalions against the anarchists and the Pumas and people like that than it was against the fascists. We got to keep that in mind. Nobody knows exactly what Tito was doing in Spain. Tito doesn't say what he was doing in Spain, which is an even stronger sign. I mean, if he was in there swinging against Franco, you know, you'd think he'd make a big point of it. But on the other hand, if he was in there swinging in Barcelona, he might want to be a little quieter about it. And I suspect that that's what he was doing. Anyway, I don't think they really had purified the theory of people's war to the extent that they had now. They hadn't had all the experience with it. And Tito did a couple things that Mao or Ho Chi Minh would never have dreamed of. He engaged in some very dangerous experiments in the efforts to build an army that could contend with the Germans. The partisans organized what they called proletarian brigades that not only launched attacks on the cities, but organized rebellions in cities, other than, except for Belgrade, and seemed to have seized factories, etc. Now, they had a hard time, and it was very slow going, but after the Soviet victory in Stalingrad, a general uprising developed, and soon Tito had an army of 300,000 partisans that were holding down 30 German divisions. Now, 30 German divisions, I don't know what exactly that figure amounts to, but it's something like it's at least 400,000 troops. So from the Russian point of view, from the Soviet point of view, it was rather important. He was doing whatever differences they might have over how he was doing it. It was something that they weren't going to throw away too lightly. There were differences of opinion between Tito and Stalin on how to proceed. They both favored a popular front. They both favored collaboration with and support for the so-called democratic imperialists. But Stalin wanted Tito to dissolve the proletarian brigade and form a front with the right-wing royalist government in exile. But the right-wing royalist government was clandestinely supporting the fascists against Tito. So Tito said, we do have a popular front. We have all kinds of, we're trying to get all kinds of bourgeois forces involved. And he pointed to some minor bourgeois and petty bourgeois forces that he did have around. But he can't work with these rightist groups. They're attacking us militarily. They're killing off our people and still carry on an effective war against the Germans. When Tito came to power, however, relations with Stalin improved a lot, or so it seems. Tito involved the head of the government, in the London government in exile, in his government, and the person remained in the cabinet until October 1945. But nonetheless, you had a real revolutionary uprising, which, while it was dependent on the Soviet victories and loyal to Stalinism and the political ideas of its leadership, was not directly dependent on the Soviet army and the Soviet CP. When Tito came to power, certain radical reforms were carried out immediately that were long delayed in the rest of Eastern Europe. War profits were confiscated, and there were large-scale nationalizations. In some ways, the regime resembled the early Castro regime, except for one thing. Tito instituted a police state throughout the country and arrested all dissidents, either to the left or the right. Even though the revolution had a broad popular support, it was hardly a school of unfettered thought, as Castro used to call the Cuban Revolution. Now, the Subasic, who was the bourgeois figure in the government, thought that the situation was out of control and that he wasn't playing much of a role in stopping it, left the government in October 1945. And by early 1947, capitalist property relations had been eliminated, and they had initiated the first five-year plan in Eastern Europe, real five-year plan, that is, planning the entire national economy. Now, because of this, the fact that he had an independent popular base and he was not dependent on Soviet troops, Tito was inclined to develop Yugoslavia's own national economic plan and not to subject it to the Soviet Union's dictates. And he had proposed to the other states in the area that they create a federation of East European states in the Balkan Danube area to create a regional plan. Such a federation would also give these regimes a little more leverage as against the Soviet bureaucracy. Because of the fact that the Soviet Union had not structurally assimilated these countries at all, each of these countries now had its own bureaucracy, which had its own difference of interest with the Soviet bureaucracy. And a lot of these kind of leaders, like Georgi Dimitrov, and the chief of Bulgaria, Imre Nagy in Hungary, and also Janusz Kadar in Hungary, and Władysław Gomułka in Poland, were interested in the idea. This terrified Stalin, and he launched a bloody purge throughout the countries that he dominated in Eastern Europe. He tried to launch such a purge in Yugoslavia, too, but only his side got purged instead. Thousands of members of the CP were caught up in these purges. He tended to kill almost anybody who had any roots in the countries at all and might not be completely subservient to the Soviet bureaucracy. In June 1948, he launched a public campaign to overthrow Tito and to isolate the Yugoslav workers' state. And that public campaign, Stalin showed absolutely no interest in whether a worker state survived in Yugoslavia or not. In fact, his campaign had two alternatives. He wanted either to bring it solidly into the bloc or push it solidly into the imperialist camp, but one thing he didn't want it doing was playing an independent role as a worker state. That was one thing that was out. It was during this period, as the last vestiges of capitalism were falling in Eastern Europe, and with the Tito-Stalin fight, that the actual crushing of the working class of Eastern Europe was carried out. Until then, the bureaucracy had played off the working class organizations against the bourgeoisie and vice versa. Now that it had taken the dangerous step of breaking with the bourgeoisie and overturning capitalist property relations, the bureaucracy needed to crush the workers in order to prevent movements in the direction of a political revolution. And the Stalinist bureaucracy in the Soviet Union had the added incentive of crushing movements in the direction of national independence. And it was an ugly slaughter replete with frame-ups. It was in this period that the Soviet army began to play a more and more central role in East European politics. Before then, they had remained somewhat in the background. They directly took over the defense forces in Poland. Now remember, when the Polish were fighting the actual counter-revolutionaries, the Soviet army had to retreat to the background. Now that the capitalists had been overthrown, and what they were confronting was the working class and the possibility of independent friends in the CP, they directly took control of the defense forces, and Marshal Rokossovsky, a Soviet general, became the Minister of Defense in the Polish government. And he remained that until 1956. The reason for this kind of a move in Poland was that the Polish CP was too close to Gomułka, who was an avowed Polish nationalist and had openly defied Stalin. He was finally jailed, but he was a little too popular to kill. Kadar, who is now the leader of Hungary, was jailed and tortured. He had his fingernails torn out and all kinds of other things done to him. Laszlo Rock, who had undertaken the assignment of leading the crushing of the bourgeois parties in Hungary, was hung as a United States spy. Slansky in Czechoslovakia was hanged. Stalinist leaders in every country were eliminated to assure maximum subordination to Stalin. Now, the workers' councils that had existed in a very limited and bureaucratized way were totally disbanded at this time, and the industries were totally subjected to the managers. Trade unions lost any semblance of independence. All independent parties were crushed. Forced labor and forced collectivization were introduced. You had the full creation of police states modeled on the Soviet Union. And you had the same thing in Yugoslavia on a different scale. There you had a movement, mass movement, with some independence of Stalin. The bureaucracy could operate in its own national interest and mobilize a certain amount of support. Nonetheless, there was a fundamental problem in common, a bureaucratic caste raising itself above the masses, a police regime, and vast privileges which were officially supported by the regime. Tito, in his left attacks on Stalin, one of the favorites was, I saw an interview with Tito in an issue of the Fourth International in 1951, in which he talks about how he goes to some of the leaders of the Yugoslav CP, he's saying, and I tell him, you've got to get out of your big cars occasionally and talk to the masses. This is literally what he says. This is his anti-bureaucratic friend. So it's sort of like the difference was not over whether to have the big cars, but over whether, you know, you should have the windows rolled up all the time. I would regard that as a tactical difference. I mean. While they allowed certain reforms, Yugoslavia was the first country to carry out decentralization, for instance, which at that time looked like a democratic reform, and now we see another, I mean, gradually we've begun to learn through the Lieberman reforms that there's another side to decentralization and stuff like that. Although they carried out reforms like that, looking back on it, it seems clear that the regime remained Stalinist all the way through the process. Now, I think it's important to get a total picture of what the Stalinists did in Europe and a balance on their role. First of all, we regard the overthrow of capitalism in Eastern Europe to be a historically progressive event and one of the major progressive events of the entire period. We regard it as a real revolution, although of an extremely distorted character, but that is not enough to evaluate the Stalinist role. First of all, the Stalinist role was to delay to the last possible minute and only in its own defense carry out the overturns. The mass drive capable of carrying out such overturns was present all the way through that period, let alone what such a mass drive would have been capable of with a better leadership. They were an obstacle to it. The presence of Soviet troops in Eastern Europe was an obstacle to revolution, even though at the time of the overturns, obviously, it was the commitment of the Soviet Union to Eastern Europe was good for preventing imperialism from moving in. As we knew before, as revolution, as we knew before, Soviet commitment to the defense of Eastern Europe, but we recognized that the role that the Soviet Union took for funding Eastern Europe was one of holding back the revolution, defending bourgeois property relations, and a